Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Brian Tissot, marine ecologist and professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Washington State University at Vancouver. We'll talk about the marine aquarium trade and how the United States, as the world's largest importer of marine ornamental species for the aquaria, curio, home decor, and jewelry industries, has an opportunity to leverage its market power to promote more sustainable trade and reduce the effects of this trade on coral reefs worldwide. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is the sound of a migrating marine mammal that winters in Hawaii and other tropical waters, and summers in Alaska and other polar regions. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess what it is. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Brian Tissot, a marine ecologist and professor of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Washington State University at Vancouver, where he focuses on the ecology and conservation of marine invertebrates and fishes. His projects investigate issues at the interface between conservation science, management, and policy, and he uses quantitative statistical approaches combined with geospatial tools to explore the ecology of physical and biological components of habitat for commercially important fishes, with an emphasis on coral reefs. He is also working on developing and articulating reforms in science education. Tissot was the lead author of a recent paper in the journal Marine Policy that asserted that U.S. reforms can make the trade in corals and their fish more responsible, ecologically sustainable, and humane. He and 17 other scientists called for U.S. actions that can have a big impact on what happens in coral reef ecosystems around the world, and noted that reforms are particularly important when these reefs are already hard hit by other forces like global warming, ocean acidification, and overfishing. The trade in coral and coral reef species for ornamental purposes is substantial and growing. Each year, approximately 30 million fish and 1.5 million live stony corals are removed from the ecosystem. Indeed, the aquarium industry alone targets some 1,500 species of reef fish. Many of these fish die in transit, so that collectors are compelled to gather even more animals to compensate for potential losses. With the United States accounting for over half of this ornamental trade in live coral, reef fish, and invertebrates, Tissot and his co-authors call on this country to leverage its market demand in order to make the trade more sustainable. Specifically, they recommend additional regulation and enforcement, public awareness campaigns, certification of sustainable products, and assistance to spread best collection practices in source countries. When we spoke recently, I asked Brian how he first got interested in oceans.
Well, it's been a longstanding interest of mine. My father was in the Navy, and so you may know when you're a Navy family, we moved every 2.5 years and many, many times in the course of my life. But the only constant thing in that was that I was always near the water. And so I got attached to, you know, having the ocean. It was the one thing that was kind of constant in my life. And so over time, that kind of evolved from, you know, hanging out at the shore to when I was 13, I started surfing. And at that point, it was kind of my all-consuming passion in life. But gradually in college, it switched over to an interest in the shore and things underwater. And science became a natural interest to me, and I migrated more into marine biology. I still surf occasionally, but I'm more interested actually than in other things like scuba diving and submersibles underwater, and still, you know, doing studies on the shorelines as well.
When did you first start working on the marine aquarium trade?
Well, it's interesting. I've always had a long-term interest in aquarium fish. I mean, ever since I was a little kid, I've had aquarium, and that's pretty much right up until the last 10 years or so. But in the mid-1990s, I was an assistant professor at the University of Hawaii in Hilo on the Big Island. And, you know, I was, as a matter of course of engaging with the community, I became aware of a conflict that was occurring on the West Hawaii coast. That's the Kona and Kahala shorelines of the Big Island of Hawaii. And the conflict was between aquarium collectors, which were catching primarily live reef fish and transporting those to aquarium exporters, and people that either were, you know, ecotourism, they had small boat operations that are taking people out to view and photograph fish, or some of these large scale dive tourism operations that would take out people on ships to view ships as well, fish as well. And so part of the conflict was the perception of the decline in reef fish over time, and also some ethical issues around whether we should even be taking fish like that. People don't seem to have a problem in spearing fish to eat or fishing because that's for consumption, but some people do have a problem with the, you know, live catching fish that will never come back to their home.
And what kind of species are we talking about? Can you describe the types of reef fish and the variety that you see when you are snorkeling or scuba diving in that part of the world?
Yeah, well, Hawaii has some absolutely wonderful coral reefs, and it's not as diverse in the number of species there relative to other areas in the Pacific, but still there's over 400 species of fish and
over 400 40
species,
species
of coral. Right. And that's much less than the thousands that are found in other areas like the Philippines and Indonesia, but still quite diverse.
Just by comparison, say the reefs in the Philippines, you said, have thousands of species, different species of reef fish?
Yeah, they're much more diverse, right.
And the Great Barrier Reef in off Australia, is that
also very high? And that's mainly because Hawaii is so isolated. It's one of the largest isolated archipelagos in the world.
And are those fish, those 400 species, are some of them endemic, meaning found only in those reefs there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's about 20 to 25, 30%, depending on how you count the species of fish and higher and other things like invertebrates and seaweeds that only occur in Hawaii.
Are they always colorful fish? Are they, you know, we all have this image of all the parrotfish and angelfish and clownfish that, you know, Finding Nemo made famous.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, people generally, all the fish are pretty colorful, some more than others. But generally what people want are you know, really colorful fish that also can do well in aquaria. Some are very easy to take care of, can live on tetramin and things like that. And those typically tend to be herbivorous fishes that live off eating seaweed and things like that on the reef. So they adapt pretty well to aquaria. Other ones, for example, butterfly fish, which are also incredibly beautiful, have all sorts of different patterns and colors. A lot of them eat corals only. And so in order to have them in your aquarium, you have to be able to culture live corals, which is quite difficult and requires a lot of expertise. But there are lots of people that are very good at it, but it's not for your amateur hobbyists.
When we talk about the marine aquarium trade, what exactly are we talking about? Are we talking about just fish or corals too, or shells and everything?
Well, there's the bigger trade is actually called the ornamental trade. And the ornamental trade has to do with a wide variety of organisms that are transported to various places across the world, not just aquarium fish. So aquarium fish account for that. There's roughly 3 million fish a year that originate from about 45 countries that are just for the live aquarium trade. As part of that as well, there's also millions of live corals which are transported, and sometimes millions of pounds of dead coral, which is used in aquaria, you know, as ornamentation and habitat and things like that. But also there's things like deep sea red and black coral, which occur not typically on coral reefs, but deeper in warm and cold waters. And they're used primarily for jewelry. So for pendants on your neck, earrings, things like that. And then also things like shells. There's over 2,500 tons of shells taken off coral reefs every year. And of course, shells can be used by themselves, or they can be used in jewelry, baskets, all sorts of things. And then there's live invertebrates, which are also collected for aquarium trade. But also things like dried seahorses, shark's teeth, salmon bones, just a wide variety of different things. And really, there's aquaria, jewelry, curios. Those are the main ones.
How much is that trade worth? Is there a value that's known?
It's hard to put a number on it. It's really a kind of a data poor trade in the sense that a lot of it originates from countries in the Coral Triangle region, Indonesia and the Philippines, and it's difficult to track. But, estimates are as high as $1 billion a year in some cases, and it could be anywhere from 5 to 600 million and up. But it's a pretty massive trade.
You had said that, just talking about reef fish, for instance, that this 3 million fish involved in the trade originate from 45 countries. So where are we talking about?
30 million.
30 million, sorry.
It's 30 million.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all right.
A big difference. My apologies.
Right.
So, and from 45 countries. So what, where in the world are we talking about? Or what are the, the top 10 sort of thing?
Well, the most common ones are, again, in the Coral Triangle region in Southeast Asia. And so that primarily includes the Philippines, Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, Vietnam, Malaysia, the Solomon Islands, but also areas like Fiji, the Great Barrier Reef, Sri Lanka, East Africa, India. There's trades in all of these countries.
So those are the biggest suppliers, presumably, of the
right.
trade. And then who are the buyers?
Well, primarily the United States. We make up greater than 60% of the trade is imported from the United States. Other ones are countries like Japan, Italy, European Union, including the United Kingdom and Netherlands, France. And there's literally 100 countries that are actually importing these organisms.
Recently, there was an effort at the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species at the Conference of Parties at the March 2010 meeting to protect or increase protections on red and pink corals. Could you tell me a little bit about that proposal?
Well, I don't know much about that as some of my co-authors do, but apparently this has been tried to be listed for several years, including 3 years ago during the last convention. And these are species, again, that are part of the jewelry trade. So there's a lot of evidence, strong evidence, that these are becoming quite rare. And habitual beds that people have been harvesting for many years are showing declines in large individuals. And they may have the inability to replenish themselves on the order of scale of decades. So there's a lot of concern about those in the jewelry trade. And so the idea with CITES, Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, was to get them listed so that people would have to have a license to import them. Unfortunately, to get something listed under CITES, particularly in Appendix 2, is what they're trying to do. All the member governments have to have a fairly high degree of cooperation and agreement about that, and that was not the case for the last couple of meetings.
And then for these other species, for the invertebrates, the seahorses, the reef fish, what is their level or status, level of protection, I should say?
Well, in most cases, none. I mean, that's just really the problem. There's very little management at all. And so unless the species becomes virtually endangered, it's very difficult to get them listed on CITES or other things like the Endangered Species Act in the United States. Compounding with that is there's just a lack of information. It's very difficult to get information in a lot of these other countries. There hasn't been a lot of rigorous studies done that, because it's very complex to go into a coral reef environment and be able to sort out human impacts due to one specific type of activity, in this case, reef collecting, relative to others that come up with some hard data that really give you an idea of how many fish are taken. There's a few studies that have done that, including some we've done, but there's relatively few. So for the most part, we don't have a good handle on exactly what the impacts are like in a lot of these source countries. But we do know from the few studies and from hundreds, literally, perhaps more anecdotal studies, that in many places, these fish and invertebrates and shells and things like that are reduced to numbers that are, less than 10% of what their normal abundances are.
Within the ecosystem, what is the role of these different species that are involved in the curio trade or the ornamental trade? I mean, the reef.
Yeah, well, that's, yeah.
I was going
Go
to
ahead.
say, sort of the reef is the habitat, but you know, where do reef fish come in? Where do the invertebrates come in? Sort of, why do we care about a loss of these species?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, again, I mentioned that the largest source of the trade is in the Coral Triangle region. That happens to be the areas of highest coral reef diversity in the world, and also one of the areas that's most threatened by other human activities like global warming, overfishing, and acidification. And in these areas, these ornamental species come from a wide range of different trophic levels, that is, different positions in the food web, and they play a lot of different roles. And so the impact is relatively spread out. You know, for example, corals are really the base of a coral reef. They are the foundation. They are the habitat. And so harvesting of them obviously has a direct impact in that you're removing things that people themselves require because they exist on the fish that are there, but also the other reef organisms like fish that use it for habitat, other fish and invertebrates that might eat off of a coral, or various things that use it for shelter. Other fishes and invertebrates are herbivorous fishes, so they graze seaweeds off of corals and they kind of maintain a balance between corals and seaweeds on reefs. Other ones are predaceous fish, which control the abundance of, you know, herbivorous fishes. Sharks, for example, are top predators, and they're taken sometimes and used for a variety of things, including shark's teeth and jaws, which are dried and sold. And so there's a whole bunch of different levels that are basically represented in this trade. And, you know, what's important is the cumulative impact of those. I mean, this is not the only stressor. There's lots of other things going on, as I mentioned. And so this is kind of on top of all of that. And it's really kind of has a potential for severely disruptive ecosystem function of these systems.
So it's really it could almost be the straw that breaks the camel's back type of thing.
Yeah, it's an added stress, you know, and there's two issues here that I think are really important to consider. It's cumulative. It's on top of other issues. Certainly things like fishing in general are much larger and broader scale than the ornamental trade, but that's a trade that's that's an industry that's difficult for us to manage. The ornamental trade, on the other hand, since we import over 60% of these, we are directly part of that. And so this is something that through regulations and laws, we can actually help improve the coral reefs in that area. So, and every bit's important.
How are the items collected, and is it destructive to the ecosystem in the process?
Well, there's lots of different ways, and different people use different methods. I mean, typically for aquarium fish, most people use nets of various sorts, hand nets if they're going after single individuals, or larger gill or corral nets if they're going after groups. And those can be relatively safe in the environment. They may not cause much impact if they're used correctly. But sometimes people also use other things. And some areas in the Philippines, for example, and other areas in Southeast Asia, people use cyanide to stun fish, and then which allows them to capture them. And that's a poison, as you know. And it not only is bad for the fish, a lot of fish die, but it's also poisons other things that are nearby where the fish is captured. Other fish, because they're quite valuable, can be literally chased for hours on the reef, and people use crowbars and things to dig them out of holes and, you know, pull them out of there because they're worth a lot of money. I mean, these are extreme examples. How much is very responsible, careful collecting, and how much is destructive is really not well known. But we do know there's a whole range of methods here that are taken, shells that are just taken off the reef and dried and shipped and things like that.
And then what happens? So could you take me through the life of an aquarium fish? You know, so once it's collected, you know, where does it go? How is it transported?
Well, it's a pretty amazing process. I mean, it can be very short relative to in some places and very complex in others. So the shortest possible route a fish could take is it's collected off a reef, say in Hawaii, and that person actually also is their own exporter, and they would export it, ship it in the mail to somebody perhaps in Los Angeles, which is one of the biggest ports in the United States for aquarium fish. And then that person, the primary importer, would then sell them directly to aquarium shops, and then people would buy them there. But in some cases, in the Philippines, for example, the collectors actually give them to middlemen, and there may be two or three different middlemen, which are either financing some of the boat operations and things like that, and that eventually goes to an exporter and an importer. So literally, the fish can be taken off the reef, they can be put in bags and then handed to another person and to another person, another person. And some of these could literally take weeks to actually get even to an exporter. And of course, a concern there, and we know this is the case in some places, that, you know, that the water quality might get bad, the fish might be too many, the oxygen concentration should drop, and you can get a high amount of mortality if it's not carefully managed. And again, there are some people that are very careful about this, and they can end up with, you know, less than 1% mortality. And we know that's the case in some places. But other people are not really that concerned about, you know, how, where the fish end up. All they care about is collecting and getting those fish. Particularly in the Philippines, there's a lot of what we call rovers, which are people that don't really live in the villages. They just kind of drive around. They live in certain villages, but they drive around all over the place and get as many fish as they can from different places and really just sell them as fast as they can. And so it's really not in their interest to take very good care of them as much as it is for people that actually live in an area and kick the reef out in front of their own home.
So you said it could end up as with less than 1% mortality. What's the high end of that?
Could be 100%, and sometimes that does happen. And again, this is something we don't have a lot of data on. You know, it's one of the things we'd like to get some funding to pursue, but it's basically, you know, there's not a lot of studies. So it's gotten a lot better in many places over the last 10 years. People have been very conscious of that. And so, you know, maybe down to under 10% in a lot of facilities.
And what you had mentioned that there some of the fish were extremely valuable. You know, how much are these fish worth, and how does that value change as it goes from the point of origin to, you know, to the United States, to a pet shop?
Well, it goes up considerably. You know, in Hawaii, for example, yellow tang, which is one of the most common caught fish in that area, some of the fish there generally are sold for a couple of dollars. That's what actually people would sell them for directly to somebody that might export them. And so I'm not sure what the importer would actually buy them for, but my guess is, you know, maybe $5 or $10. What you typically see in the aquarium store in Portland, for example, near where I live, is $50 or $60.
$50 or $60 for that same fish.
Right. So, you know, like most things, and there's been economic analyses done on this, is that most of the money is actually on the retailer end, which is true of, you know, a lot of trades, of course, not just this one. But typically, most of the profit is made in the United States.
In the United States, is this trade is perfectly legal. Is that correct?
With a few exceptions, yes. Yeah, there are some things that are banned. Live corals, for example, are legal. Queen conch, you know, there's a number of species that are listed by CITES and the Endangered Species Act. You know, staghorn coral is another one of those that they cannot be legally imported or collected in the United States.
But most other things, most of the reef fish and whatnot can be.
Well, yeah, there's thousands of species of coral reef individuals, as we mentioned, and CITES really only protects five or six groups of those. And so there's really only a couple species plus live corals and live rock, which are explicitly excluded. So just a few out of the thousands of coral reef species are currently listed.
Can you tell me about any impact from this ornamental trade that you've seen on specific species?
Well, most of my work has been in Hawaii, and so that's probably very different than what you would expect in other areas like the Philippines and Indonesia. So I haven't had much firsthand experience there, except way back in the late 70s when I had, you know, lived in the Philippines for a short time. But in Hawaii, we don't really see a lot of destructive fishing practices. For the most part, people are pretty careful. There has been a few incidences where people, for example, have gone out at nighttime and have broken coral to get fish, which kind of go down into the reef at night, and they're a little easier to capture. That's about the worst I've actually seen. What you do see, and it's not something you actually notice as much as you can measure, you know, with a scientific study, is reductions in the number of individuals. So in cases before the management was implemented, their fish were reduced as much as 50% on reefs, and that primarily occurs in yellow tangs. So half of the fish were gone, and so the other half were what were left, and it's just much less than you would expect in the natural environment.
With management, can you describe, you know, how is that balance? I know you've done a lot of work related to community management of fisheries in Hawaii. And
right.
And there's this inherent tension between collecting things off the reef and then, say, tourism to look at things on the reef when
right.
you know, one will reduce it by 50% and the other wants to see as much as you possibly can. So how is that,
right.
you know, can you tell me a little bit more about that conflict and how you can resolve it?
Well, it's difficult. You know, we've been working in, and when I say we, I'm primarily a person in Hawaii, Dr. William Walsh. Bill Walsh is with the Hawaii Division of Aquatic Resources in West Hawaii. He's really been the lead person on doing that. But there's a lot of people in the state that are involved in the industry and trying to regulate it. But the fundamental conflict, as you say, it's really people that want to view the fish, get the services from those, and those who actually want to harvest it, the goods per se, you know, and especially collectors that take live reef fish. And so if you think, you know, if there's not too much going on of collecting, then it should be fine. But the perception is that it's, you know, it's a lot of fish are being taken. So when we did a study in the late 1990s, we found, again, that over half of the yellow tangs are being taken. And we determined that by comparing fish in areas that were known to be collection sites relative to ones that were closed, where it was illegal to fish. And so that conflict had been going on for quite a long time. So the community put a lot of pressure on the legislature to do something about it, and they reacted. And this was primarily Representative Dave Tarnas, who was a natural resource manager familiar with these issues, and he was from West Hawaii. And he passed a bill called Act 306, which actually helped create a very flexible management strategy for West Hawaii, one of the few places in the state that has this kind of strategy. And it created this large kind of region for the entire West Hawaii coastline called the West Hawaii Regional Fishery Management Area. And one of the mandates, and there are many, were to, you know, help establish a sustainable aquarium fishery by involving the community and by closing at least 30% of the areas to aquarium collecting. And this is what are called marine protected areas, or MPAs. And so the MPAs were implemented with the community recommendations as to where they would go in the end of 1999. They were closed in the beginning of year 2000. We've been studying them for ever since. So going on 11 years right now.
And has that resulted in increases in reef fish?
Yeah, what we have found is rather remarkable. In the areas that have been closed to collecting, the fish have increased over 50%. And so they basically have come back to what we believe are natural levels, levels that you know, were kind of before they were actually collected. And so this is overall for the whole West Hawaii coast. And we've also seen in that time that the aquarium fishery has done better than ever, you know, and we don't know exactly why that is. Some of that could be due to the marine protected areas. It's most likely it's just been, it's a growing industry and it's doing well and people are making good profit. And so the, you know, that seems that there's been winners in both cases, both the people that now have these fishery replenishment areas, and these are principally the areas that dive crew operations go into. There's lots of fish. Aquarium collectors have their own areas where they collect. And so in some ways, the conflict has been separated spatially to where they're really in different areas. Unfortunately, there still is conflict. There's quite a bit of it. It's not been totally resolved. And I think some of these things never completely go away because there's always disagreement about how you share common resources. But it has improved quite a bit.
And then do the fish migrate so that if, you know, if fish are coming back in the marine protected areas, will they eventually move or check out the non-protected areas and then possibly improve what's available for collection?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. That's the whole kind of science of marine protected areas is to help replenish fish outside of the areas where the MPAs occur. And so if 35% of West Hawaii is actually closed to collecting, 30% in the fishery replenishment areas, plus 5% from previous areas, the other 65% is wide open. And so MPAs have the potential to replenish those fish two different ways, one of which is called spillover. And that is as the fish increase in abundance inside the marine protected areas, the densities get so high, it kind of fish naturally migrate out into other areas, and in this case, open areas. And we have done studies. This was a paper primarily authored by Ivor Williams, who's now with NOAA in Hawaii. And it showed that if you look at the boundaries of these marine protected areas right next to open areas, that the abundance of fish there was not significantly different from inside the protected areas, but definitely different as you move further away out into the open areas, suggesting very strongly that in this case, adult yellow tangs were actually moving out. And we know they move several hundred feet, perhaps 1,000 feet. And so that was kind of suggesting that there's quite a bit of movement going into these open areas. And that could provide some replenishment of adults. And unfortunately, the aquarium fishery in Hawaii doesn't really target adults. They target juveniles. So it's kind of hard to know how that directly benefits the fishery, but it benefits them in the long run because the adults, of course, are what reproduce and provide small fish, and that should help in the long term.
Why does the aquarium fishery target juveniles? Just because they're smaller?
Yeah, I mean, usually people have a 10 or 20 or 30 gallon tank. You don't want a 6-inch fish in there. So they typically take these, inch or inch and a half, 2-inch fish at the most, and those are selected and sold. So it's unusual in that sense. They're not taking the big fish. For the most part, they're smaller, medium-sized fish.
And don't they grow, or in an aquarium will they not grow as much?
Well, they will grow, but they will only generally grow as big as the aquarium could allow them to. So that will limit their size at some extent.
Okay. And then
You have a
go.
big aquarium, it'll get big.
And so then go on.
You had mentioned a second mechanism.
That's all right. Yeah. Well, the second mechanism that how marine protected areas might enhance the outside areas and fisheries is called recruitment enhancement. Or larval seeding. And that's the general idea that adults in marine protected areas become so abundant that when they reproduce their babies, which will drift in the ocean for, in this case, yellow tanks, about 3 months, will then move into other outside areas and help seed those areas and increase the abundance out there. And we have a study we're hoping to get published here soon. This is authored primarily by Mark Christie and Mark Hickson at Oregon State University. And we used genetic markers, microsatellites, and actually found 4 pairs of adult yellow tangs where we actually found their offspring had settled onto a reef in an adjacent area. And what we showed is that adults inside marine protected areas provided larval fish to areas outside marine protected areas, but also to other marine protected areas, and even fish that were in open areas provided larvae inside marine protected areas. In other words, there's high connectivity between all these populations. So that's the whole idea of a marine protected area network, which is what's in West Hawaii, that it all kind of works together to increase the fish across the whole coastline, and perhaps even to places like Maui, by drifting in the ocean.
So now that you're starting to work in Maui, will you be able to tell if that, how far that impact will reach?
If we did another study like that, those studies are fairly expensive, but yeah, it wouldn't be that hard to do that to see whether they've gone that far. I mean, one of the fish we found went, I think, over 100 kilometers. In other words, the adult was 100, over 100 kilometers from where we found its offspring. And so from one part of the Big Island to Maui, it's not even that far. So it definitely could to do that. So we don't have plans for a study like that, but that might be something that we could do in the future.
Interesting. And then I'm just curious because a lot of the studies, it seems, focus on yellow tangs. Is there a reason for that?
Well, we primarily use them. They're kind of a proxy for the trade in general. And that's the main reason is 70 to 80% of all the fish harvested in West Hawaii and Hawaii in general are yellow tangs. And so they're kind of an icon for the industry. But keep in mind the aquarium industry in Hawaii literally has hundreds of species, although really there's about 8 fish that constitute over 90% of the fishery.
You recently released a paper in the journal Marine Policy on how U.S. ocean policy and market power can reform the coral reef wildlife trade. And so I wanted to talk about, both what prompted this call to action and then what you're recommending.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the paper actually came out of a workshop, which occurred during May of 2009 in Washington, D.C., which was on international trade and ornamental species. And this was organized primarily by Kara Cooper, the Environmental Defense Fund, and Barbara Bess at USAID, and sponsored by the Kingfisher Foundation. And what they did was they brought together a wide range of experts, over 40 people, that were both scientists, policymakers, government people in the industry, and basically what the idea was to find if there's a consensus about the trade from all the different perspectives, kind of do a very broad literature review. I mean, for my one section on ecological impacts, I looked over 200 papers, and I did that along with one of the co-authors' paper, Todd Stevenson, who's my graduate student here at Washington State University, who assisted on the paper, is also a co-author. And all these people basically got this information together. For one day, we had nothing but talks about the trade, trying to get everybody up to date on that. And then second day was working groups talking about solutions. And so this paper basically outlines what we found in terms of the trade itself, the impacts, management, and also what we recommend in terms of ways to improve it.
And given that the U.S. is 60% of the market of demand, you know, how can the U.S., you know, what reforms can the U.S. make to make the trade more responsible?
Well, generally, what we found is there's four main areas that we recommend, and that is, since the U.S. is the leading importer, we can also provide leadership and help change this. And so the areas were, first of all, that the laws that currently exist are inadequate. And as you mentioned earlier, CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species, is difficult to use to regulate the ornamental trade into the United States. So that law by itself is not sufficient. And so what we recommend is that there's be some new laws that would help promote sustainable trade. That is, literally try to put some kind of limits on imports very carefully, obviously, because this is a something that's quite difficult. And find a way to import fish that have some kind of knowledge about where they came from and how they were collected. In other words, try to be selective about people that are very careful in harvesting fish and transporting them, and versus those that do not. And so have a law that would filter that out.
And to get that kind of knowledge about where they came from and the way they were collected, what would that require?
Well, that's, you know, going to be one of the more difficult aspects of it. And I think we all agreed this is a very difficult problem. Even these things we're recommending are likely to take a long period of time. But I think there needs to be some leadership here. We need to change things. It just, it currently as it's going, is not sustainable. And so one of the second recommendations was we need to promote reform and best practices in source countries. And so the U.S., again, is a leader in the world, can help places, and we're doing that now, and we should continue to do that. Places like the Philippines and Indonesia help improve their management practices by supporting them, training them, working with communities there. There's lots of good people in those countries that are very good at what they do, and getting it so they're the ones that actually are able to provide, for example, proof that their product is sustainable. So along with that, and this is kind of item number three, would be to provide some kind of market incentives. And this could be like the Seafood Watch program, for example, or other seafood programs that kind of label seafood as being from good fisheries, okay fisheries, and bad fisheries. By the same token, you could have certain kinds of exporters that have incentives to prove that their fish are being sustainably fished and handled and marketed. And so provide a way of certifying those kinds of importers and collectors, and being able to show that there's a chain of custody here that involves good practices. And so that shifting the market demand would be really important. And a huge part of that, and this is one of the reasons we wrote this paper, was improve education, make people aware of what this issue is, that, you know, it is an important issue and what they should do about it. I mean, freshwater fish, for example, 95% of those fish are cultured, and very different from marine fish, where 95% are wild caught.
And what about your fourth recommendation?
The last point, the fourth thing we recommended, was improved enforcement, because even with the current laws and regulations, enforcement is very inadequate in the United States. And that is that ports of entry in which imports come into, there's only so many of those. There's only so many people that can handle this. And they're really inundated with too much work. So if we did increase regulations, it would require, you know, much better enforcement in that route to actually make these laws work.
Who at the ports, would that be Customs, the Fish and Wildlife Service, Wildlife Inspectors?
Yes, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
And because there's only like a little bit more than 100, 114, I believe, wildlife inspectors across the whole country. So a staffing issue as well.
The talk I heard at the meeting was bewildering in terms of what they have to deal with. And not only is there not many people, but the training that somebody would have to be able to identify different species of fish and corals and shells is just amazing. You really have to know what you're doing, and that takes a lot of time. And so to do that right, this needs to be more money put into this to build, a good trade, a trade that people can be assured that what they're doing is not significantly harming coral reefs.
Taking each of these steps in turn, it seems a lot of it's hinged on this best, on the best practices. And are those, it sounded from the discussion we've just been having that a lot of those best practices are already known, or is there more research that needs to go into what works, what types of management practices are better?
Well, I mean, I think there's a fair amount of knowledge on what works and what doesn't. But I think the key thing is in a lot of places is the communities themselves have to come up with something that works. It's very difficult to have top-down management. And in the Philippines, for example, really this the local municipalities that have most of the legal authority. And so you really want community-based management as much as you can. Although if you have larger laws that provide a framework, that can be extremely useful as well. So there might be different solutions in different places. So the idea is to provide, economic development and scientific expertise and work with people to where they find solutions that work, and then try to get their products to market where people say, hey, this is a good fish. This fish has been harvested from this village, which is known for these kinds of practices. And if there's some assurance that that's true, that would be, a reasonable way to accommodate those fish.
And then is there, like you had mentioned, the Seafood Watch, is it possible to include this within that, or is there any organization that is currently working on certification?
There is the Marine Aquarium Council, or MAC. They have been trying to do this for many years, and particularly the Philippines, but throughout other places in the world, in the Pacific. But it's been very difficult, and I think they've had some success. But a large part of their inability to make it work is that that's only one piece of the solution, and so we believe these other pieces have to be in place. In other words, people can be certified and shown that, they're having good practices if indeed there's enough training and oversight these things actually work. But then people need to know that here's a product that actually, has a chain of custody, for example, that we know there's good practices. People need to be educated about that. They need to, at the pet store, be able to make a choice, presumably based on one that is certified and one isn't. And of course, all of that requires other things, regulations, improved management in source countries, things like that. So that's just one piece of the puzzle, but certainly an important one.
And then on the enforcement, what's required for that? You talked a little bit about staffing and budget. Always the
Right.
tricky sticky wickets.
Well, that's really the biggest thing is the ports that do exist. Again, Los Angeles is a primary port for imports, just because the largest volume is in the Pacific. There is a fair amount coming in from the Atlantic and the Caribbean as well, but just not enough people, not enough physical people to sit there and sift through all these things. And so, they get hundreds of shipments a year. Each shipment can be multiple boxes. Each boxes can be multiple bags. Each bag can have multiple species. And you just can imagine what it's like to go through these things day after day. It's very diligent, very time-consuming work. And they just need more people that are trained to do that. And of course, a lot of the species that are coming in, there's no laws that are preventing them from coming in, and we don't know how they were collected or anything. So that's one link in the chain, but it's part of a larger recommendation that we're all making.
And what has been the reaction to these recommendations, both
Well,
in
it's still a bit early, so I can't say too much, but we have seen a few people that have written about our paper. In particular, some hobbyists have actually taken pause to think about this. And I think, and I'd like to believe, and I think this is true, is most, fish hobbyists in the United States are very concerned about where their fish come, and I'm sure they're concerned about coral reefs. And it's not that, they're not concerned about it. It's just that it's very difficult to be able to know what to get and where it's from and how to distinguish between, good players in the market and bad players. So one of the reactions that we've seen that was published recently was to, you know, that there really should be some movement on the role of the hobbyist in terms of this issue. So I think that's been very positive.
Well, that is interesting because oftentimes the hobbyist could be against it, but in this case, probably why you have an aquarium in the first place is because you love it.
Well, right. And I think, you know, I have no problem with aquarium. I think they're great. I've had one for many years and they're great educational tools. As long as people know how to really take care of their fish and do a good job, there's nothing wrong with them at all. In fact, you know, you would hope that people would have these, it would make them even more sympathetic towards conservation of coral reefs, the very ecosystems they came from. So that's a group that should be very concerned about this. And I think they are, you know. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people that are threatening the industry. And so they often get threatened with lots of cases that are trying to shut them down or eliminate them. And so, yeah, not everybody's happy about what we probably had to say, I imagine.
What's the next step then?
Well, the next step, from what I understand, is to try to, you know, lobby for some new legislation. I think that would be at least in terms of the overall issue. I mean, I have next steps myself personally as well, but I think that's kind of the next step from this paper would be to try to get some laws, some bills introduced that would actually start to address some or all of these issues.
And so, if people were interested in learning more about this issue, where should they go? What types of, are there any websites you'd recommend or organizations you recommend they check out?
Well, yeah, sure. There's a bunch of them. I mean, again, Tara Cooper was one of the lead persons on this project. She's with the Environmental Defense Fund. They would obviously be a good one to look at. Some of the other groups, Pew Environmental Group is behind this, as well as the Kingfisher Foundation. They might be places where you could find information. NOAA, of course, has a lot of information about the ornamental trade on their websites. There's actually a lot of literature, including hobbyist sites on the web. I would just encourage people to search for aquarium trade or ornamental trade, and they'll find quite a bit of information and a lot of research papers. You know, so people can certainly contact me as well. I guess the only caveat I would have about what I've said here is that I'm a scientist, and so my expertise in the area of ornamental trade is primarily focused on ecological impacts and ecosystems. And my comments on policy, on economic, on social science, and other aspects of the trade are better addressed by a lot of my co-authors. So I would encourage people to contact them directly if they have questions about different aspects of the trade, as they're much more knowledgeable than I am about this.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about the marine aquarium trade with Brian Tissot, marine ecologist at Washington State University at Vancouver. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of a migrating marine mammal that winters in Hawaii and other tropical waters and summers in Alaska and other polar regions. It's the sound of a humpback whale. The humpback is a baleen whale that you can often see breaching and slapping the water. They're perhaps the noisiest and most imaginative of the whales when it comes to songs, with complex and almost eerie songs that include recognizable sequences of squeaks, grunts, and other sounds. These beautiful songs can last up to 20 minutes and are often repeated for hours at a time. The purpose of the song is not yet clear. It appears that only the males sing, and that they only sing these complex songs in the warm waters, perhaps for mating purposes. In colder waters, they make rougher scraping and groaning sounds, perhaps to locate large clumps of krill that they like to eat. Listen to one of these eerie songs of a male humpback whale.
Thank you. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.